I'm Suzanne Hogan. Steve Kraske is away. This is Up to Date. Every day we should be asking ourselves three questions. One, how do we make sure America is a magnet for good jobs? Number two, how do we equip people with the skills they need to get those jobs? And number three, how do we make sure that hard work actually pays off in a decent living? That quote is from President Obama. He said that yesterday before announcing Thomas Perez as the next Secretary of Labor. Our guest today has some ideas on possible ways of addressing those questions. Unions. Today on the show, a look at the current health of America's labor movement. In an economy recovering from the recession, where the unemployment rate is at 7.7%, we'll debunk some common anti-union rhetoric and discuss the current challenges and complicated relationship between labor and politics in a globalized world. Plus, later in the hour, a look through the lens of National Geographic travel photojournalist Catherine Carnell. But first, labor in America, look at unions and their relationship to democracy and the economy. Joining us today in the studio, Bill Fletcher, author of They're Bankrupting Us and 20 Other Myths About Unions. Bill, welcome to the program.
Really glad to be here. Thank you.
Bill is a longtime labor activist and co-author of Solidarity Divided, The Crisis in Organized Labor, and A New Part Towards Social Justice. He's also worked with AFL-CIO, the Industrial Union of Marine and Shipbuilding Workers of America, and many other labor organizations. He'll be speaking tonight at the Kansas City Public Library Central Branch. Let's talk first about President Obama's appointment of Thomas Perez as the new Secretary of Labor and these three questions he says we should be asking ourselves. What's your reaction to that?
My reaction to the appointment itself is cautious. Perez has a good reputation, but my concern is largely about the role. The role of Secretary of Labor has diminished over the years, and actually what we need in Secretary of Labor is someone who is a very, very staunch advocate for working people. Francis Perkins was the iconic image for that role. That's what we need. And what's happened over the years is that we've had increasing numbers of people who, even if they were once advocates, have become much less so.
Unions in the United States have never represented more than 35% of the workforce, with numbers declining significantly lower today. What is the current health of the labor movement in the United States today?
We're in a very precarious situation. The percentage now is roughly 11 to 12% of the non-agricultural workforce. And what's been happening, particularly over the last 30 years, but actually the decline begins in the 1950s, is orchestrated efforts to undermine the ability of workers to organize or join unions. And so we have this National Labor Relations Act passed in 1935, which in its beginning, in the beginning of the act, indicates that it's the public policy of the United States to support collective bargaining. But for the last 30 years, that has not been the public policy. And so what's happened is that even though we have this law that says that people can actually join or form unions, it has become more and more in the interest of employers to break the law because the penalties are so minimal.
Skipping forward a bit, unions lost a lot of political power in the 80s after 11,000 air traffic controllers were on strike and then fired. I'm wondering if you can talk about how that really shifted things for the labor movement in America.
Yes. Well, the shift begins actually, I would say, in the mid-1970s with the recession of 73 and the beginning of this real wave of plant closings that start to creep around the country. But with PATCO, what PATCO represented was a signal to employers, public and private, that it was really okay to move actively against unions and that the public and private employers would actually have the support of the president. But what's important that we should also understand, and there's a great book on PATCO that just came out by Joseph McCartan called Collision Course. And part of what's important to understand is that Reagan's initial impulse was actually not to fire the workers. It was a segment of his administration that realized that this was an opportunity, and it was the opportunity that they needed to blunt the strength of labor. Now, fast forward to our present. What we're looking at right now is not an attempt to blunt labor and blunt the ability of workers to join unions. It's to annihilate us. When you look at Wisconsin, or you look at the passage of so-called right-to-work laws in Michigan and other places, these are not efforts aimed at weakening an already weakened movement. These are efforts aimed at eliminating unions from the scene.
Labor really took a big loss in Wisconsin. And I'm wondering, what have we learned from Wisconsin? How are labor organizings changing in the way that they're trying to organize and mobilize and to be more effective?
There's a lot of discussion that's been underway since the events in Wisconsin. And I cannot say that there's a consensus yet, but some of the things that are being discussed include the fact that there needs to be much more internal education within the ranks of organized labor, that you have too many union members that in many cases don't even understand the role of the union and may see it as an obligation on their part to participate. So that's one of the critical things. The second thing is the need for very strong alliances with other groups in society. And part of what I feel about what happened in Wisconsin, particularly with the recall, was that the recall for many people was seen as a effort to defend collective bargaining. Okay. But if people don't know what collective bargaining is, it's very hard to rally to it. On the other hand, had they turned the struggle into a real struggle for economic justice, I am convinced that they could have won. And I think that the same is true in Michigan, that when unions are focused on what appears to the outside body to be institutional interests, we lose. When, however, we focus on the broader issues, we tend to win.
So there's this need for education, just even within unions. And that was some of the inspiration for writing this book, when a woman approached you on a plane and, you know, was interested in what you were reading, but had no idea what a union even was. And so why don't we just lay it out there in really basic terms? What is a union, and what are the goals of unions?
So I appreciate you telling that story, which I'm going to tell again this evening. Unions are, first and foremost, organizations of workers. It's that simple. They're organizations of workers that come together to fight for justice. And their fight may be justice in a particular workplace. It may be justice in a particular industry. It might be economic justice in a particular geography. But that's what they are. And they are broad and diverse, by which I mean that they are not organized on the basis of ideology in the way that we would understand ideology. They're organized on the basis of, we come together to fight for fairness. We want to make sure that when we work hard, that we are compensated. We want to make sure that we work in a safe environment. We want to make sure that people have an ability to get jobs. That's what a union is all about.
You're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. I'm Suzanne Hogan. We're talking with union activist Bill Fletcher about his new book, They're Bankrupting Us, and 20 Other Myths About Unions. Bill Fletcher will be speaking this evening at the Kansas City Public Library Central Branch. Have you had an experience with a labor union that made you question its validity? Are union labor still relevant in American society? Give us a call. Our number is 816-235-2888, 816-235-2888. So this book, it's kind of a set the record straight style of book. Why do you think that this type of book is relevant at this time?
For a few reasons. So the book is written in many ways as a discussion with that woman on the plane. It's not a book. Imagine this, that I'm sitting down at a Starbucks and this person says to me, Bill, explain to me whether unions are corrupt. So what I attempt to do is I attempt to write in a way that does not assume that the person is stupid, assumes the person may lack certain information, gives my analysis, but also does not treat unions as a panacea. See, I grew up in a certain way. My parents were both very pro-union, and both were union members. My mother is still alive, and she's a retiree in the American Federation of Teachers. But as pro-union as they were, they never let me believe that unions were perfect. They always pointed out that there were different ways that unions could exist and could practice. And I try to convey that in the book. And particularly in a day when you have Fox News, which I think is an oxymoron, I think that you have a situation where there is these constant attempts to demonize unions when unions are mentioned at all, I should add, to misconstrue the role of unions. And I felt that, yes, it was important to write something that does set the record straight, but doesn't paint some sort of fancy picture. That's an illusion.
Can you give a specific example of some of this misinformation that's out there about unions?
Well, one is contained in the title, Unions Are Bankrupting Us. The notion that unions are the source of the economic problems of states, counties, municipalities, for example, is completely ludicrous. The issue that we face economically is about revenue. And particularly when you're in a recession, it's about a revenue shortfall. And it's about tax policy. It's not about whether or not you pay janitors a dollar more or less. It's about how do you receive or obtain the types of funds that are necessary in order to sustain governments. And so what happens is unions end up being a very good scapegoat when governmental authorities do not want to deal with the tough questions of revenue. This is true in the private sector as well.
I'm wondering, there's another myth in here. Unions and corporations are both too big and don't really care about their workers. And you say that's a myth, but
right.
You really think that corporations, large corporations, really care about their workers?
No, corporations don't.
And do unions, and they have this hierarchical structure, and
right.
There is a lot of money involved in political agendas here. I mean, do you think they really care about the workers in this fundamental way?
Yes, in part because they have to. That is, they're two very different kinds of organizations. A corporation exists to make money. There's no one from any kind of mass base that elects the leaders of corporations. They are chosen by people within the corporation or from shareholders, often representing other corporations. Unions are democratic organizations with a small d. That is, they are run by their members. Now, does that mean that they're perfect? No way. Does that mean that there can't be corruption or other problems? Absolutely, there can be. Anytime there's money, there can be corruption. But part of what I get at in the book is that these are organizations that are membership organizations. The members, therefore, have to, if they want to ensure that the organization is going the right way, they have to become active. And one of the things that struck me when I was researching the book, I came across a book I'd forgotten that I had, which was from 1985, the President's Commission on Organized Crime in Unions. And it was identifying several unions. At the end, when they were discussing the conclusions, one of the things that they said was that one of the best ways to deal with organized crime in unions was to have fully functioning democratic organizations where there was essentially an impassioned belief in the philosophy of trade unionism. I couldn't believe that that was in such a report. But the idea there is that it's really up to the members to decide. There's nothing like that in corporations.
Well, there's this idea that a strong union is key to democracy. But with so few people really participating in parts of unions today, what is the relationship there? Is it as valid as it used to be?
It's more valid. And I would pick up on this the first part of what you were raising. That when you have a society that does not have free, independent unions, you have a society that cannot be democratic, that will, in fact, be authoritarian. And that's precisely the way the United States is moving, that we have this vast polarization of wealth that is also translating into the political realm, so that working people have fewer and fewer options other than picking Tweedledum or Tweedledee. They have very few options in terms of actually mobilizing and engaging in political struggles. That's why unions are so important and have always been important. And so the slow decline of unions should be a worry for everybody, irrespective of whether they're in a union.
We're talking to Bill Fletcher about his new book, They're Bankrupting Us, and 20 other myths about unions. Another myth that's in here is unions are so partisan. They always side with the Democrats, mm-hmm. right?
Right.
Well, don't they support a lot of Democratic candidates? Is that, are they not partisan and have their own agenda, especially public sector unions?
They have an agenda, and they need to have an agenda, because workers need to have an agenda. Do they tend to support Democrats more? Yes, that's true. There's a long historical reason, which we don't have time to get into. But the summary is this, that what we have right now, and I'm only going to focus on the moment, is we have two parties, and one party, the Republicans, have basically made it clear that they want to eliminate unions entirely. So while there are individual Republican representatives who may take a different point of view, the prevailing view in the Republican Party is the need to eliminate unions. Then you have the Democratic Party. And within the Democratic Party, you have this ongoing struggle about whether unions are important or not, whether there are other constituencies that are more important. You have within the Democratic Party a rising segment that is immersed in wealth. And so unions tend to say that we may have a little bit more of an opportunity within the Democratic Party than we do within the Republican Party. My argument is that first and foremost, what unions need is their own independent agenda. That is, they need an agenda that represents the interests of working people. Then what unions need to be doing are advancing their own candidates or supporting candidates in either party, but it's going to more than likely be more Democrats, that will support our agenda. That's the starting point. And my criticism is when I find unions that do not think first of our about our agenda, that may end up being lapdogs of this or that Democrat. I'm not interested in that. But I think we need to be clear that it's very difficult to say, well, why don't we support more Republicans? Well, I can give you a very good answer. When the Republicans don't have a .44 Magnum pointed at our heads and saying, we're going to take you out, then there may be absolute room for a discussion. But until that time, we're dealing with a life and death situation.
You really feel that the current political agenda of the Republican Party is that anti-labor union?
Absolutely. When you have the Republican candidate for the president write off half of the country, I'm talking about Romney's 47% remark. I mean, they're very clear. When you have the Koch brothers funding these so-called right-to-work initiatives, you just have to listen to the debate in Congress, and you understand that their effort is not a so-called leveling the playing field. Their objective is changing the playing field entirely, essentially eliminating an entire team.
We're talking to Bill Fletcher, labor activist and author of They're Bankrupting Us and 20 Other Myths About Unions. We're going to hear from Richard in Prairie Village. He called 816-235-2888, 816-235-2888. You can also email us at update@kcur.org. Rich, welcome to the program.
Yeah, hi. Mr. Fletcher, first of all, I do support industrial unionism, but I am a little bit leery of trade unionism. And also of the fact that often the economic agenda basically overwhelms social agendas. And I give you two examples from the history here in town. One is that there's a very strong machinist union at the local nuclear bomb plant, and they really support that industry. Number two, there was a eminent domain campaign a number of years ago called the Sailor Project, which was pushed strongly by the Labor Council here in town, condemning an entire neighborhood of small, nice little houses so they could just have the jobs to build new apartment buildings there. Your comments, please. I'll just take it offline.
Wonderful question. So my first answer is you've got to read my first book, Solidarity Divided. I agree with a lot of what you were just saying. I think that within the union movement, it is absolutely the case that there are those that are focused on their narrow concerns. They see their interests in the narrowest of terms. And I absolutely agree with you. I think that we have to struggle with that. And I'll give you a perfect example of a positive representation, and that was the Chicago teachers' strike that just recently took place. So before the Chicago teachers' strike, the predictions had been that this was going to be a narrow special interest strike of teachers. The leadership, a reform leadership, took over, and they began an internal educational effort as well as a coalitional effort in the community and turned their entire struggle into a fight around the future of education and of the children. That's exactly the direction that we need to be going. So I think you're right to raise criticisms and concerns when it appears that a union is only looking out for its own interests. Now, let me just put a caution note here, that part of the problem is that when you have a union that, for example, is facing decline in their industry, layoffs, et cetera, there is an air of desperation, which is very predictable. I used to be a shipyard worker, and shipbuilding has been a declining industry in the United States for years. And the leadership was desperate to get work for the members. Now, they tended to look for military production. My difference with them was that there was actually non-military production that we could have engaged in, but the narrowness of the leadership led them to go all along the very traditional route. So I think it's important to understand that there are imperatives that are pushing the leaders often in narrow directions, but our job is to really push them in another way and to force them to look outside of the box.
We're going to hear from Neil and Raymore. Neil, welcome to Up to Date.
Thank you. My name's Neil. I'm a 40-year retired member of the DC3 Painters Union, part of the building trades. And I agree with Mr. Fletcher. I haven't read his book, but I plan to. Spot on in his analysis. And the previous caller, I think I'd maybe correct him a little bit. The Honeywell plant was done by a major part of the building trades in Kansas City. I think it's they make guidance systems. I don't think they make nuclear bombs out there. And the Sailors Project was a project that there was a lot of problems with. The building trades tried to work out a workable solution also. My only other comment would be that the building trades in Kansas City, whether painters, carpenters, electricians, anyone that's in the building trades, I would like to be for people in Kansas City to know that they're most well-trained, highly skilled workers in their particular craft, and we pride ourselves in only working safe but efficiently. And as an officer in my local for a number of years.
Thank you, Neil, for the call. They do make parts for nuclear bombs, but kind of with that idea, I mean, there's all these different unions that exist, and I kind of wonder why aren't some industries unionized? What I think of, the service industry, or there's so many trades that are totally left out of this process. And I'm wondering why some areas have been organized while others have not.
A large part of it has to do with the narrowness of many of the leaders of our movement. I mentioned in the beginning that the decline in organized labor starts in the 1950s, not by a loss of members, but as a percentage of the workforce. The workforce was growing. Part of what was happening in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s within the leadership of much of organized labor was a failure to appreciate the way that the economy was changing, the production of new jobs, for example, the different types of jobs, new technologies. And so there was this conservatism. I don't mean like politically right wing, but just a sort of conservatism not embracing the way the changes were underway. So there was a failure to think strategically about, all right, there's a new sector that's emerging. What are we going to do? What's our strategy? So that unfortunately what happened was that many new sectors of the economy emerged almost completely non-union. I mean, you know, for example, in the United States, very few bank workers are organized. Whereas in other parts of the world, like in Brazil, there's a very thriving bank workers union. Unions, the sort of narrowness, strategic narrowness, which I speak about a great deal in my first book, captured us.
How does America compare to the rest of the world as far as the strength of its labor movement? Are there some countries that are way more pro-union than others?
Absolutely. What you find in much of Western Europe, particularly in Scandinavia, but also in places like South Africa, you have unionization rates that are anywhere between 30 and 50%, in some places even more. But what's been happening globally is that with the change in the way the economy globally, with the development of what's called neoliberal economics, there's been an attack on workers internationally. And so you have seen in a number of countries a reduction in the percentage of the workforce as both technologies change as well as employers decide that it's time to take out unions.
With this idea of job outsourcing to other countries, and this still leaves the American worker in competition with jobs that are overseas, but really with no way of fighting that. I mean, how do you think that we can address that?
We have to rebuild the union movement, but we have to rebuild it not just in the United States. We have to really think globally. You know, when many of these discussions about subcontracting ignore an interesting fact, which is that it may be subcontracting, but it's often within the same company or it's within the same network of a particular company. So when people say, well, the Chinese are taking our jobs, well, not so fast. You know, you'll have these multinational corporations that may have been based or may still be based in the United States that set up operations in other places to take advantage of lower paid workers, different kinds of working conditions. We have to think about rebuilding a union movement that is strongly committed to social and economic justice here as well as globally. My experience is that when we make that connection and we show that the union movement is not just fighting for in the interests of those people who happen to be in unions, but is fighting in the interests of the broader public, we will get on a roll. If we, however, only think about we've got to get more jobs for the people who happen to be union members, we're history.
I want to talk a little bit about methodology. March 20th is the National Day organized by the Union of Federal Employees to protest the sequester. And I guess I just wonder, how much can protests and rallies and even strikes really put a dent in government budget cuts, you know?
The March 20th events that you just mentioned, that American Federation of Government Employees is really taking the lead on, I think have to be part of the puzzle. That simply showing up one day, even with a large number of people, and protesting is insufficient, and sometimes is laughable. That what we have to do is we have to sway public opinion. And in that sense, strikes can be very useful in swaying public opinion if, for example, the strike is in an industry where it really makes – a strike will make a difference. But more importantly, if the broader public believes that the workers who are striking are in the right, just as they did in 1997 when the Teamsters went on strike at UPS. In the case of federal workers, we can only win the battle around sequestration if we convince the larger public that sequestration – is raw punishment of federal workers for something that a problem we did not create. And that sequestration will affect and will undermine the condition of the larger public. That's our mission.
That's Bill Fletcher, author of the new book, They're Bankrupting Us, and 20 Other Myths About Unions. Bill Fletcher will speak this evening at 6:30 at the Kansas City Public Library Central Branch, 14 West 10th Street. You can find more information about it at kclibrary.org or on our website at kcur.org. Bill, thanks for joining us this morning.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.